we don't want a chance of having, you know, one of the bears attack a person, hurt them or kill them.
The state takes legal action against a man who feeds bears. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 19th of May. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a controversial shooting range proposed for the Matsue Valley.
On a busy weekend, you can, you know, have 400 or 500 people out there and having fun in the sun.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free Quit Line counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. 1-888-842-7848.
A Squantna man who has gotten international attention for feeding bears outside his cabin faces 20 counts of criminal misdemeanor charges for his activities. State records show that Charlie Vandegraw, who has a summer residence in the Yentna River drainage system, has previously admitted to the activities, but says that he felt he could not stop because that would put his neighbors at risk. Vandegraw has been the subject of several movie and television pieces about the bears. He recognized the danger of having black and brown bears so close to him, but he told 60 Minutes last year they are his guests.
I've been slapped. I've been knocked unconscious. I've been T-boned by large bears and knocked to the ground and had a hard time getting up. I've been thrown to the ground by bears. But it was in no way that any of those was an all-out attack.
The state troopers don't see feeding bears the same way Vandegraw does. Beth Ipsen of the Department of Public Safety says there's a reason a law forbids intentionally feeding bears. She says a fed bear is a dead bear.
They're not domesticated animals. They're dangerous animals. If you have them returning to a civilized area, if you have them, you know, around humans, it's going to create a dangerous situation, possibly, injury to a person. And we don't want to chance that. We don't want a chance of having, you know, one of the bears attack a person, hurt them or kill them.
Vandegraw will be arraigned in Palmer District Court in June. Bodenburg Butte, just southwest of Palmer, is a rural community edging the Knik River. The area is popular with local folks for its fishing, canoeing, and hiking opportunities, and for some less than quiet recreational fun, like target practice. Now a rifle range, proposed as part of the new Knik River Public Use Area Plan, is causing some Butte residents to dig in against hosting a shooting gallery in their neighborhood.
From day one, we opposed the locations of the shooting ranges throughout the process. We and the neighbors up in Mott Road have complained for 20-some years about the gunfire coming from these same areas where they're going to put a legitimized shooting range.
That's Britt Lively. On a dreary, rain-soaked day, she's sitting by a blazing wood stove in her soon-to-be-finished new cottage. Lively is vehemently opposed to the shooting range, and so is her partner, Gregory Nielsen.
People that live on Knik River Road can hear gunfire from that location and from Mud Lake. It just echoes across the valley.
The noise of shots ricochets off the mountains, she says, disturbing residents miles away. And she wonders about the effects on migrating birds and area moose and Dall sheep.
Add to that the spring runoff through this lead-filled area is going to poison, without a doubt, regardless of what they consider to be a safe area to shoot, it's going to poison the water downstream. That means Jim and Mud Lakes, where the swans are.
According to Lively, in the 2 years of comment periods and public hearings it took to outline the Knik River Public Use Area Plan, their input was ignored. She suggests shooters go to commercial ranges.
For $180 a year, you can shoot there all you want. The Mat Valley sportsmen have an indoor range in Wasilla.
But Mark Woodchuck,
I am a hunter and a shooter and a reloader,
says that's not a viable idea.
There is the Isaac Walton shooting range over in Birchwood, but their hours are such that a guy who's working all day long can't get there in time before they shut down at the end of the day to go shooting.
Woodchuck lives on Maud Road.
And I'm at the last house at the end of the road,
where the asphalt ends and it becomes a rough dirt track through birch and cottonwoods.
Right now what you have is you have a lot of shooting going on all over the area out here. Who knows which direction people are shooting? I have a sign here by my house that says, caution children at play, that is full of bullet holes. And if you look at that sign, some of those bullets that went through that sign probably hit my house.
Woodchuck's home is 2 miles from the proposed range, but he says he can't hear the guns.
And if people are shooting right there, they're shooting against the hillside, so the bullets are focused in an area, and we don't hear that at all. And it's the people that are shooting much closer to here, you can hear the gunshots. So if they're shooting out there, that is totally fine. And I don't think anybody in this neighborhood would hear it at all.
Caught between these opposing viewpoints is Dave Griffin, the manager and sole staff assigned to the Knik River Public Use Area by the State Department of Natural Resources. As rain pours down, we're lurching along muddy Maud Road past Woodchuck's to see an area clear-cut in anticipation of the shooting range. We encounter only one other traveler.
You heard of this before?
What's that?
Have you heard of the Knik River Public Use Area?
No.
Yeah, it's pretty new. It's all state-owned land once you get up the road a little ways here.
Wow.
And just trying to bring some attentive management out here.
The clear cut, which makes opponents of the shooting range furious, is some 600 feet long by 100 feet wide. DNR says it's a timber sale, one so small that no EIS is necessary. Birches, just recently leafed out, lie in the wet.
One of the reasons that people think that this is a good location for the development of a range is because there's no trails back at the base of those mountains. And if there are any sort of errant bullets or gunfire, then you've got the mountains to help stop it. There's no houses back there or anything like that.
Griffin says it's important to remember that under the land use plan, DNR has the power of enforcement. He says the target shooting at the new range will be regulated for the first time. Right now, he's hiring state troopers who want overtime to come out and patrol the area.
The troopers will be looking for folks breaking that rule. On a busy weekend, you can, you know, have 400 or 500 people out there and having fun in the sun. And in the past, there's been folks that are shooting into the hillside while folks are recreating, which creates an unsafe situation.
He says trash is a problem, too. 200 feet from the clear cut, the current illegal shooting gallery is littered with spent shotgun shell casings, plastic bags, and squashed beer cans. New regs will mean a ban on littering. But that doesn't placate Lively's group. Butte Area Residents Civic Organization, or BARCO, has filed an appeal in state superior court seeking that the Knik River Public Use Area Plan be rewritten. She says the current plan is not in accordance with the language of the 2006 legislation that created it. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, volunteers in Homer keep the firefighters in good spirits.
Well, that sort of little personal touch of appreciation goes a long way towards building morale.
That's just ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org. And by STEMS Floral Artistry and Gifts for Giving. STEMS in Anchorage at 563-3366.
Wildfire conditions are ripe across much of Alaska right now. As warm, dry weather evaporates moisture released from snow and ice melt, Alaska Fire Service spokesman Doug Stockdale says the situation is providing a ready environment for fire starts across a swath of the state.
There's some red flag warnings about low humidities and winds, especially around winds around the Anchorage area. But around interior Alaska, we have red flag warnings for low humidities. That means our fuels are drying out, grasses, brush, things like that. That's what we call flashy fuels, as well as the larger timber that burns very quickly.
Stockdale says early wildfire starts often result from brush burning, campfires, and other human activities, but that the season's first lightning-caused ignitions could be on the way.
we are expecting the possibility of a thunderstorm starting maybe as early as Thursday, and that means possibility of having lightning-caused fires.
There were several human-caused fires in the interior in recent days, including one near Fort Yukon that smoke jumpers attacked aggressively over the weekend. Stockdale says a larger prescribed fire on Fort Wainwright went well, but did spread smoke over areas of Fairbanks on Saturday. One of the big stories of last week's East End Road wildfire in Homer was how well the local community pulled together to support the firefighting forces. KBBI's Casey Kelly reports.
The McNeil Canyon Fire Station is bustling with activity. On a normal day when there might be a couple volunteer firefighters hanging out waiting for a call to come in, it's a lot quieter than this. But today, the bigwigs from state and federal fire crews have set up shop to battle the East End Road wildfire. Pete Buist is a spokesman for the Type 1 Incident Management Team, which was called in Wednesday and has been using this facility as an operations center. Buist says on some wildfires, the Incident Management Team doesn't even have a building that they can work out of. They just work out of tents.
What we have here is a generous offer from Ketchum Emergency Services to be able to use their building where we've got some telephone lines and a little bit of computer support and this sort of thing. Unfortunately, for those of us who are trying to watch our weight, this is also where a lot of volunteer food is showing up.
Buist jokes that when he came to fight this wildfire, he weighed 220 pounds. When he leaves, he expects to weigh more than 250. Across the room, Balda Ziamelis isn't helping Buist keep his waistline in check. She's restocking the M&Ms.
Everybody loves M&Ms, so we keep a dish out, and we ran out of it this morning. So now we have more M&Ms.
A steady stream of donations started shortly after the fire began. Several individuals, groups, and businesses from Homer provided food, blankets, clothing, just about anything firefighters might need. Volunteers at Haven House made sandwiches, Fat Olives supplied pizza, Fritz Creek General Store gave salads. Ziamelis points to a whiteboard on the wall where firefighters have been keeping track of everyone who has contributed.
The first three columns are people and businesses and restaurants that have donated, and they keep coming. That's not the only time. And then we have volunteers to help out if need be, and everybody's just pitching in.
Ziamelis herself is volunteering in the kitchen, making sure those M&Ms are stocked and the coffee stays warm. She's a retired nurse and says she wants to help because there was a fire on her street a few years ago, and she remembers how generous others were then.
We had a fire on Mansfield, and I felt sort of like I could contribute my time and help out the community and help out the firefighters and do what I can.
Buist, who's been fighting fires in Alaska for 41 years, says a little bit of hospitality means a lot to the crews on the front lines.
Well, that sort of little personal touch of appreciation goes a long way towards building morale.
As work on the fire moves into the mop-up phase, firefighters are no longer accepting donations. In fact, so many came in the first few days after the blaze broke out that they had more than enough food and supplies to last several wildfires. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
An organization managing flood relief is narrowing its request for help. Arlen DeYoung with the Alaska Volunteer Organizations Active in Disaster, or VOAD, which includes the Red Cross and many other groups, says they're trying to organize donations so that residents of flood-damaged villages get what they need. DeYoung says not everything donated is helpful.
Donations can become a disaster in itself, and people will use that opportunity in which they perhaps clean out their garage or their closets and will send unusable types of items. So they're like skis or neckties, and specifically to a village location, those types of things are needed.
DeYoung says the easiest and best way to aid village flood victims is to make cash donations to accounts set up to help. Alaska Natives with roots in five Southeast communities will get their own village corporations under new federal legislation. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski introduced the Landless Native Bill as part of a package aimed at improving the region's economy. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Natives in Ketchikan, Wrangell, Petersburg, Tenneke, and Haines would become shareholders in new urban corporations under the legislation. The bill calls for each corporation to receive about 23,000 acres of land and $650,000. But that could change in the legislative process. Previous bills failed to pass, and Murkowski says another approach may be needed.
At one point in time, what the individuals were looking for, they wanted their land. Well, pretty darn difficult to make these land conveyances, and we see that. We're certainly seeing that with the Sea Alaska land conveyance. So we've talked about is there a possibility for compensation in some other way. How they are recognized, how they are compensated is undetermined.
The bill is called the Unrecognized Southeast Alaska Native Communities Recognition and Compensation Act. It aims to resolve what advocates call a major flaw in the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. They point out that the five Southeast communities were denied local Native corporations, unlike the rest of the region.
They looked at this back in 1994. They determined that there really wasn't a good reason that they had been left out, except that at the time, the land around these villages was locked up in long-term timber contracts. Well, that might be an explanation, but it's not really a good rationale for why only five communities basically get left out of ANCSA.
Murkowski admits getting the bill through Congress will be difficult. Any land would come out of the Tongass National Forest, drawing opposition from conservation groups. She will pursue the legislation in the Senate's Energy and Resources Committee, where she's ranking member. But the panel is tied up with other legislation right now.
Once the Energy Committee can turn from the energy bill at hand and look to some of these other land bills that we have in front of us, then I think we might have a shot at educating some of our colleagues in terms of what the situation was and why it's important that we be able to provide some relief.
The bill is one of several introduced this spring targeting Southeast. One would complete Sea Alaska Regional Native Corporation's land selections. Up to 85,000 acres would include Prince of Wales Island timber stands and economic development sites throughout the region. Another bill would fund retooling and other efforts to help the region's timber industry adjust to the current market. Yet another measure would fund ferry repairs and new vessels. Murkowski is also pursuing bills to support ocean energy development, and she's part of an effort to get the federal government to recognize hydropower as a renewable, non-polluting energy source.
We recognize that the economy is not good down there. We anticipate a downturn in the tourism market, and that's not going to help us. So as we look to legislation and areas that we can try to make a difference for those in the southeastern part of the state.
Murkowski is partnering with fellow Alaska Senator Mark Begich and Alaska Congressman Don Young on some of the efforts. She says the best chance for several of the bills is to attach them to other legislation. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Sitka.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and healthy salmon in the Copper River watershed. On the web at ecotrust.org/copper river. And by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
Sitka Senator Bert Stedman says the legislature will not overturn Governor Sarah Palin's decision to reject stimulus money tied to energy standards. But he says she should accept the funds, and he says concerns about strings attached were overblown. Stedman, who also represents Wrangell, Pelican, Ketchikan, and Petersburg, says the funding programs left the state with few long-term commitments.
We did not have much agreement with the administration from the onset with the stimulus. When we reviewed it, we found that the initial reviews weren't what we expected. We thought there would be a lot of strings attached, and we were unable to find those.
Stimulus dollars required some new state hires, but Stedman, addressing a recent Sitka Chamber of Commerce meeting, says some of those jobs were already on the table.
There would be, dealing with public safety, a requirement to hire six new troopers for domestic violence and sexual assault, and the testimony from the Commissioner of Public Safety is he's going to hire him anyway, because that's where the need is in Anchorage and Fairbanks and out west. And they're looking forward over the next couple of years of expanding their employee base to deal with those issues.
While Stedman supports using stimulus money, he says parts of the overall program were short-sighted. He believes it could have been better designed to create more long-term economic benefits. Alaska statehood pioneer Tom Stewart is now remembered in law as the namesake for a new legislative building. Governor Palin yesterday signed legislation naming the Capitol Annex the Thomas B. Stewart Legislative Office Building. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has more.
Most Juneau residents think of it as the old Scottish Rite Temple at the corner of 4th and Seward Streets next to the Capitol. The city and borough of Juneau bought the building in 2006 and transferred it to the state of Alaska. Tom Stewart is known throughout Alaska as the Secretary of the Constitutional Convention. But in Juneau, depending on age and your place in life, he's known as Representative Stewart, Judge Stewart, or just plain Tom. A decorated World War II veteran and member of the 10th Mountain Division, he grew up skiing here and hiking every mountain. Mount Ben Stewart above Eagle Crest Ski Area is named for his father. Meeting in Juneau yesterday, the Alaska Supreme Court took a break from its proceedings to attend the signing ceremony in Court Plaza. Justice Walter Bud Carpinetti refers to Stewart as a shaper of the Alaska court system. As one of the architects of the Constitution, Stewart studied state judiciary systems all over the U.S., and he often said Alaska's was the envy of every other state. He was administrative director of the courts in the early 1960s and a judge in the 1st Judicial District of Juneau for 15 years. Chief Justice Dana Fabe says naming a legislative hall after Stewart is especially fitting for this rare Alaskan who served in all three branches of state government.
He understood the need for collaboration and cooperation among our three branches.
Juneau Representative Beth Gertula likes to remember Stewart as a territorial and state legislator.
Judge Stewart, Representative Stewart, wrote some of the foundational legislation for this state. I mean, he created the Division of Lands and the Department of Natural Resources. He created many parts of the court system. So not only was he a foundation of this community and to many of us personally, but he was also a foundation for the state.
Stewart died in 2007, and while his legacy is large, his son Caleb says his father would not want all the attention.
Dad would kill us right now. It was not him, you know, so I just want to remember that this is all about us. It's for the people who are still with us and the people who are yet to come.
A half block down 4th Street, the Stewart Building is being remodeled for legislative offices and hearing rooms. Silver Bow construction crews did not take a break to attend yesterday's ceremony. Marty Susort was working outside the building.
Starting to tape and paint inside. Then they'll be doing some finish work, putting in cabinets and countertops, and putting in doors and windows. They're going to be putting the bridge up pretty soon, so that'll be something for everybody to look at.
The Stewart Building will be connected to the state capitol by a skyway bridge. Work on the project is to be finished this fall. The old Scottish Rite Temple was the Masonic headquarters in Juneau for more than seven decades. Dedicated in 1928, the Art Deco-style building had a lodge room, a ballroom, museum, kitchen, and large dining hall. The measure naming the old building after Tom Stewart was introduced this past session by former Juneau Senator Kim Elton. It easily passed the legislature. Even lawmakers who opposed the conversion of the building to a legislative hall supported its new name and the chance to honor a great Alaskan. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Petersburg streets were packed with locals and visitors over the weekend during the 51st annual Little Norway Festival. The celebration of Norwegian culture included 4 days of food, music, art, and more. KFSK's Alex Hotz attended a variety of events and has this report.
Anyone in Petersburg who wasn't living under a rock this past weekend probably heard this. As always, music was a big feature of this year's Little Norway Festival, the name given to the annual celebration of the town's Norwegian heritage. For the past few years, the Pickled Herring Band of Washington State has provided many of the tunes for the day's events, and this year was no different. But music was just one item on the laundry list of attractions that visitors enjoyed during the four-day Mayfest. There was a softball tournament, various art shows, rose mulling classes, a muskeg nature walk, a packed beer garden, and of course, the town's pelt-covered Vikings and Valkyries.
Jennifer Peterson is hereby taken for incarceration for the criminal act of molesting halibut fishermen.
Jack French of Eureka Springs, Arkansas, was unlucky enough to get thrown in jail by the roaming horde, but he seemed to enjoy the experience.
I think it's fantastic. I wish I had one of these coats. Or at least a set of horns.
We got a new prisoner!
We don't have that guy stuff in Arkansas.
And the annual festival parade down Main Street was a big and noisy success. On Saturday, young anglers learned how to hook a fish for dinner during the Dolly Derby in North Harbor. And later that day, Petersburg High School hosted an all-you-can-eat shrimp festival. One of the newest additions to this year's festival was blacksmith Keith Fremlin. He was working on a steel rose when I ran into him on Main Street.
These leaves I just forged out, put that together, and then I'll put that on the stem. And once I get that on the stem, then I'll put this on the end of the stem and peen this down. And then it's just a matter of bending it around.
If you hadn't yet had your fill of Scandinavian culture, the Little Norway Festival pageant had plenty more to offer. Leading the young Lycoring dancers through their moves was Heidi Lee, and the Pickled Herring Band was there to provide the soundtrack. By Sunday afternoon, after a pancake breakfast at St. Catherine's Church and a bacon barbecue at Sandy Beach, the festival had run its course. Stuffed with beer bits and smoked salmon, I'm Alex Hotz in Petersburg.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Broth in Fairbanks, Casey Kelly in Homer, Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, and Alex Hotz in Petersburg. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Susanna Caldwell. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com. Sooner or later, the H1N1 swine flu will come to Alaska. There are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands. Stay at home if you're sick and contact your health care provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.